Hiya, Wunju. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Curb. I'm Andrew F. Pierce, and this is the podcast where I bring you in-depth interviews with filmmakers, creatives, and curators of culture. This podcast is recorded in Boorloo, Western Australia, sovereignty never ceded. Ever since he was a kid, Darwin Schultz has had a creative streak that has reimagined the role of nature and the environment in association to our humanity. At 12 years of age, Darwin won the award for Best Film by a Child Producer, Best Cinematography and Best Editing at the Kids Flicks Awards for his short film Red Panda Man. He had also previously made a claymation short film called My Eco-Friendly House. And he was also a Tropfest Junior finalist for his short Milk. Again, he was only around 12 years old at the time. Flash forward about a decade, and Darwin's creative streak continues with his latest short film, Bluebird, a brilliantly realised short that pays homage to classic swashbuckling films from the early 1900s. Bluebird features musical sequences, fighting, and romance, all with the backdrop of glorious green environment that elevates the adventure of the story of a princess seeking revenge in a delightfully entertaining way. There's a level of vision and scope at work within Bluebird that is a rarity for Australian films, and it's that vision that underpins the following conversation with Darwin, recorded ahead of the Bluebird's Australian premiere at the upcoming Fantastic Film Festival Australia. Bluebird will be screening in the Sydney Shorts package alongside a smorgasbord of great local talent, including Chris Ellener's latest film Passion Pop, who we have an interview with on thecurb.com.au. I'll stick a link for that in the show notes as well. Bluebird is a film that is designed for an audience to appreciate and enjoy on the big screen. There's an understanding and appreciation of cinematic language and the possibilities of creative storytelling that makes the work of Darwin Schultz a delight to watch. In the following conversation, Darwin talks about how his journey into filmmaking began, what it means to have supportive parents who encourage his creative journey, and how he managed to create the distinct and expansive look of Bluebird on a micro budget, including all the great, great nature and mountains and everything that he's got on screen. It's a real delight. If you want to find out more about the work that we do on The Curb, then head over to thecurb.com.au. We have an array of discussions and reviews for Fantastic Film Festival Australia underway, so head on over and check them out. We are also completely independent and ad-free website and live on the support of listeners and readers just like yourself. So to support us, visit patreon.com/thecurbau, where you can support our work from as little as $1 a month. Bluebird screens as part of the Sydney Shorts package at Fantastic Film Festival Australia on 27th of April 2025. I'll stick a link in the show notes with all the details, but for now, here is a trailer for the festival, followed by my interview with Darwin Schultz. Concept for Bluebird, like it's such a wonderful ode to classic cinema from the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. You know, this style of filmmaking which really isn't made anymore. I'm curious for you as a filmmaker, where that interest or that desire to utilize that particular style for this story came about.
I think I've always really loved the warmth and the nostalgia with those old movies, where when you watch them, you, even if it's not like a warm scene, a lot of time you still feel like comfort just because it's old and you know that everything will be okay and everything's got that beautiful grain and that glow on it. So I think a lot of it was just like anamoya, nostalgia for a time you've never known, because I wasn't alive when those movies were coming out. But I think that growing up with them in the 2000s as a kid, I was like, oh, this still feels warm and old even for me now. So I think I've always wanted to recreate things like that just so that I can kind of get back to that childlike feeling. And then I think by taking that and kind of putting a revenge, more modern approach to medieval fantasy with that, you know, kind of just juxtaposing the two worlds together.
Mm. Were there any particular films that really stuck out to you as ones that lingered in your mind? This is the kind of one that is like the peak one that I think of when I think of those films.
Yeah, definitely. It's not a medieval fantasy at all, but just The Sound of Music is, I think, favorite old musical, because that was pretty much the first musical I ever watched as a kid. So when the helicopter comes in over the Austrian Alps every time, that makes me tear up. So I think I just wanted to go for something even like 1% of the way to that, where it's just the beautiful nostalgic feeling.
So then let's talk about the musical aspect of it, because we don't get to see too many musicals. And while this isn't a musical all the way through, there are aspects of it which are just, I love musicals. And so getting to see something that is pushing into that kind of style of filmmaking and storytelling is delightful. What was the choice behind that?
Actually making it a musical at the beginning was kind of just to really suck in the audience and make them think like, what am I watching? Because I can't remember the last time I saw a short film where it actually was a musical, let alone brought somebody in with a musical, made somebody think, what is this? And then completely subverts and flips on its head and removes all the musical elements. And if anything, does the opposite, and it's far more drawn out and slow after that. So I think that I once I had the idea of doing a musical, even if it was kind of like, oh, it could be a musical and it could be funny and it could be a joke, I think I got really like latched onto the idea of just opening a short film with a musical. And then after a minute of all this joy and happiness and like flooding it with joy and happiness, then you just subvert it.
Yeah. But I mean, there's nothing that's like, I guess, like taking the piss out of the style. You know, it is really affectionate. It is so clearly made by somebody who loves everything there. How important is that to show that kind of affection? And because so often when we have these kinds of stories that are trying to pay homage or play with an older format, there's a level of mocking them or, you know, oh, can you believe that they did this kind of stuff? But not here. And that's so refreshing to see. How important is that for you?
I'm glad it's refreshing. Super important. I feel like quite a few of the movies I've done could walk the line of being a parody or being ironic, but I think that I'm sincere enough as a filmmaker, and I truly love the things that I love enough that, not even by design, just by accident, I think that the final product ends up not feeling like it's mocking anything. I think it does, just because I love the references so much. I think it always ends up in a place of, even if it's a little bit wonky or not exactly like the references, I think it still feels very sincere.
Yeah. I mean, and sincerity is, it's a bit of a shame, but it's a rare thing nowadays, right? And the same goes with honesty and openness and that kind of desire to show the world in a different light. And I know, like, I've watched some of the stuff that you've done previously, but specifically the cinematography work that you've done too. And you present the world in a completely different stance where you just kind of go, oh, I didn't look at it this way. I didn't think of it this way. And that's a rare gift in a way. And I guess in a long way, that's a way of saying, I know that you won an award at like 12 years of age, you know, and so your perspective of seeing the world differently has kind of been something that has always been there. And I'm curious if you can kind of expand on that, on how you see the world, on what makes your point of view, what makes the Darwin point of view different than what other people see.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you think I have a point of view. I think it's very hard for me to objectively think about. I think I was given my first point and shoot camera at the age of 6, and I started doing stop motion mainly. So I think stop motion is probably a very nice gateway into it, because you don't need any other people to do it. And then I think it was probably around when I was 11 that I got a camcorder and started doing live action with my friends. But I think primarily I've always started off as a visual filmmaker. Now it's kind of a balance between, when I come up with movies, it's music and visuals, but a lot of the time I still am a visual filmmaker, and I work primarily as a cinematographer and a visual effects artist. So it's all coming from a place of visuals. So I think a lot of the time, instead of having a really great story idea and then building everything off of that. I think a lot of time I'll start off with what do I want it to look like and what do I want it to sound like and how I weave things through it. And in terms of my actual shooting style, I don't know why it is the way it is. I think I've just been doing it since I was a kid so long enough that it's just evolved. And I don't really think about the cinematography of my own stuff as much anymore. I think from conception of an idea, I know how to shoot it and I know exactly what I want it to be like. And it's just a matter of executing.
With that in mind then, like, it sounds like you had really supportive parents or people who guided you into a creative view and a creative stance. And I apologize, you can hear my dog tip-tapping on the floor there, but I'm really curious then how much, like, that's clear, it's evident in your work, but what kind of things did, was it your parents, was it another family member who guided you in seeing how to use a camera, how to frame a shot, that kind of stuff? What kind of guidance did you get there?
Yeah, so neither of my parents have anything to do with filmmaking, but they were still, for some reason, really supportive right from the beginning. They gave, because they would have bought a new point-and-shoot camera and then had an old one lying around. They're like, this one can be yours, and pretty much showed me things like Wallace and Gromit and Jason and the Argonauts and even the old 1930 King Kong, and kind of were like, well, this is what stop motion is. This is how it works. Here are some Lego figures and a camera. Go and experiment with it. And pretty much every step of the way helped me with what I want to do. I would say, I don't know how to do this. And if I was too young to Google it and figure it out myself, they would just help me because they could see that I was obsessed with filmmaking and just wanted to help push me in the right direction. And constantly were showing me the behind the scenes of movies. So any movie I'd watch, they would figure out a way to show me the behind the scenes and I'd watch it on loop.
I mean, it's comforting to hear. Like lately I've been talking to a lot, I mean, I'm in my 40s, right? So my experience of growing up with film is very different than your experience. Yeah. So, and I've been talking to a lot of younger filmmakers about their journey into filmmaking and getting to see that filmmaking was a possibility, right? Because not everybody has the notion that, can I be a filmmaker? Can I do that? And I've heard the, you know, through different people, just like you've mentioned, getting to see the behind the scenes stuff of people doing the work, watching behind the scenes films. And I know specifically like the Lord of the Rings stuff was, it continually gets mentioned as being like, hey, look at what can be done on a grand scale. And there is this vision there. And I guess in a tangential way, like Bluebird kind of, the vision and the scope of it, the reason why I bring Lord of the Rings, it's like there's a line there, right? And I'm curious, as you're talking about those behind the scenes things, was that this sense of watching them going, maybe this is something I can actually do going forward. This is a possibility. This feels like something that's accessible. Is that what you felt?
Yeah, I think that I fell in love really just with the magic where I'd watch a movie. And, you know, when you're a child, a movie is just a movie. You can't figure out how it's done. And then when you watch something like Lord of the Rings behind the scenes and you see that it's just a bunch of lovely New Zealanders sipping on coffees, waiting in between like storms to get a perfect shot. And then you see the way that the camera moves up a hill on a jib. I think I just seeing that the curtain be pulled down and actually just seeing bit by bit how technical it is and how methodical it is. And I just fell in love with that individual process of it, where it really is magic, but it's magic through a lot of hard work and a lot of thinking and a lot of collaboration and people. And yeah, definitely Lord of the Rings was the behind the scenes of that shaped a lot of my filmmaking.
With a film like Bluebird, you've got your script, you know what you're going to do. How's your storyboarding process? Do you take shots? Do you go out to nature and take photos and then lay it out? Or do you do a previs? Or how do you work with your planning of what the look is going to be like?
Yeah, so it depends on the scene, because some scenes I think are simple enough in the content that we will just completely wing it. We've gotten pretty good at now, if we're super confident in what we want, just going out and shooting it and finding a shot. And if we have time and we don't have too many other people and say that's pretty quick. And then for the more technical scenes like musical, we pretty much shot the whole thing on an iPhone with Zach, the producer, and another friend as a stand-in, and they were running through the forest, and I was running there with my iPhone tracking along, and we pretty much just shot the whole thing lip-syncing on an iPhone and then cut it together, and then that was our storyboard. So we had a full moving storyboard that pretty much had frame accuracy in the edit, so we could know exactly how long a shot will last and exactly what framing will come next. And we find that normally doing full edits beforehand is a really, really concise way to do storyboarding. It also allows us to kind of see the flow and in those shots that we've come up with, see if they still work even when they're in sequence. Because a lot of the time you'll storyboard something and then you'll cut it together in the edit and you're like, oh, something feels a bit clunky here, might have to change it up. But in the act of shooting the whole thing once before, even though it's only 10% effort, in that act of shooting it all, you kind of find where all the kinks are.
I love hearing that because it is something that I think a lot of people don't consider in the filmmaking process or don't implement as part of their process of getting something that is polished and works. And even on independent films or micro budget films, like that's still there. It's available. Like as you're saying, you're shooting on an iPhone and you're not doing everything like to 100%. It's just to see if it works. But I'm then curious, like if you build an edit through that, do you still get an understanding of what the emotionality of the film is going to be? Like when you're watching it, even at 10%, do you feel like that aspect, or if it's is it just the visual side of it that you're like, yeah, this works on a visual level and the emotionality comes later?
I think that a lot of the time the actual shooting process is such a technical one that a lot of the time it's very, very hard to feel the emotion in the shooting. I think in pre-production and in writing you can be really, really sure of what your intentions are and how you want an audience to feel, and you can be 100% sure of if we do this then it hopefully will feel something like this will land in this ballpark. But I think that on set, a lot of the time, it's extremely hard to know what you're doing or why you're doing or if it'll even work at all. And then you just have to trust in the work you've done before that. And then in the edit, it's either going to work perfectly or you're like, oh, maybe we should have changed it. But a lot of the time, shooting is such a technical process. You can't let the emotions get in the way. You just have to get through it and know that the pre-production is worth it.
A lot like, so you did the cinematography for The Overthrow, which is a film that is ostensibly about environment, saving nature. Environment and nature plays a major role in Blue Bird as well, and the visual style of it is so intensely green and nature rich, which is just a beautiful thing to be able to sit and experience. Can you talk about the allure and desire to explore our relationship with nature? Whether it's, through advocacy and people trying to save it, or having people, engage with it, sing in it, live in it, that kind of stuff.
I think that pretty much every idea I'll ever have will incorporate some sort of nighttime exterior, partially because I just think that they look so beautiful when you see moonlight coming through a forest. It just something inside of me lights up. But also just I think that it adds an expanse and a production value that you can't get from shooting just interiors, because a lot of times sets are, they require so much lighting and they require so much time, and then you step outside and you find a beautiful location and then all the work is done for you and you just press record and it looks amazing. Obviously in this film there's a lot of digital manipulation, but I still think that 90% of the locations are just what I felt when I was there. Most of the time I would decide to shoot there or even write in a scene because I've just been spending a lot of time there for fun, because I love going on walks. So a lot of it's in the Kurnell kind of area or the Royal National Park of New South Wales. And I just loved going there and was kind of like, oh, what if you shot a scene here and this could happen here because of the way that the landscape happens. So I think it's a lot of the time I'm heavily inspired by the natural places that I go.
And when you're out there in nature, Like, this all sounds such like an airy fairy question, but when you're out there in nature, what does it do to your mind? How do you feel when you're immersed in nature?
I think filmmaking is so written into my code and my DNA that a lot of the time when I'm in place, beautiful places, all I can think about is what I could film there. And I'm actually not as in the moment as I should be. But a lot of the time I could be in the most beautiful place ever. I'm like, oh, it'd be really cool to shoot this here. So that's normally what's going through my mind.
But I imagine then as well, like, because I've seen some of your photos too, and where it's like you just transported there, right? And that's, again, it's a rare gift to be able to just take somebody somewhere. And the landscape does a lot of the work there, but it's, well, it's the framing and being able to place somebody in that moment. And I imagine when you get home and you've already been thinking about, gosh, wouldn't it be nice to shoot there? And then you see what you've actually shot there. Like, it's got to be refreshing to be able to go, yeah, it works. It
Yeah.
works. What's that feeling like when you get home, look at your computer or your TV, and you go, yeah, okay, I've got the shot?
I think it's probably a 50-50 gamble of whether I'll instantly go, yes,
Yeah.
that we love that. It couldn't be more perfect. Or being like, have to sit on this one and figure out later whether we still like it or not. And I think a lot of the time it's you either need to love something instantly, or you need to give it space and come back to an edit a week later or a month later to really understand if it does work or not. But definitely when you do get those hurrah moments, when you start to piecing together the night of shooting, that's always really satisfying.
I'd love to talk about as well, as you mentioned, there is the digital side of marrying up the visuals of the landscape and then creating that digital marrying up of that aspect. Can you talk about the process of how you managed to get something that looked natural and felt organic?
Yeah, so I think I started I taught myself After Effects on YouTube tutorials when I think I was 11. I got After Effects, and since then I've just been honing in the skill of compositing more than anything. So a lot of people I know can do 3D animation or very technical things like that, or fluid simulations. I can't touch any of that, but the one thing I am really good at is compositing, where it's just the act of getting multiple different layers and different assets and smushing them together to look as real as possible. So a lot of Bluebird is I'll have my base shot, and then I'll have a photo of mountains and a photo of six different trees and then six different rose bushes, and then I spend days and days and days figuring out exactly the position of everything and the right shades of green to put into everything. And it's almost just at that point digital painting. You've just got all the little tiny bits and you're just repositioning them at different depths to find out what looks the most cinematic.
I love the, as you're saying, digital painting, right? Because there's that
Yeah.
feeling of it being real but unreal. And then there's that feeling of the whole, you know, the backdrops that they used to have, these beautiful painted backdrops that they used to have. And I miss seeing those on screen because it felt like just, you know, somebody's spent so much time and effort. And as you've said, like, you're spending so much time learning how to do this. So the skill is there. But that again comes back to the aesthetic style of the film too. How important is it to kind of create that backdrop, that painted backdrop style, which was so prevalent in the 1930s and 40s? Getting that particular aspect right, that's got to be hard.
Yeah, well, particularly the way that we achieve that look is for the opening musical scene. We wanted it to look like it was in a fake forest in a studio on a back lot somewhere. That was kind of the look we were going for. We didn't want it to look like it was a completely real alive forest. And so in my head, the easiest way to achieve that was, okay, we shoot at night and then we shoot in a real forest, but then artificially light it. So you get this really weird kind of quality of light where it's definitely not sunlight, but it doesn't look like nighttime either. It looks like a lit stage in a way. And then in order to get the background to feel like a painting, we hung, I think it was, we had 3 12-foot green screens in a row side by side to cover the length of our walking track, and then heavily lit them as well so they were bright enough to separate from the green of the trees. And then and then I just put on all these set extensions in post. So you end up with this really uncanny look of, okay, all the foliage is real and I think the trees are real, but nothing looks like it's a real forest. Everything looks quite artificial.
I mean, in the moment, I thought, geez, they've done a really good job of creating a real looking set here, you know?
Wow,
So
that's great. I'm glad you believe that.
it works. And I'm excited to, you know, to hear what people feel about the film, having seen, well, when they get to see it and project in the cinema. And we'll get onto that in a moment, but I want to talk about Annabelle Wolf as well, because she's so captivating and again leans into the look and style of those films. What was it like casting her for this particular role?
Yeah, so I've worked with her sister Phoebe for quite a few years now. So Phoebe and I started off as a director and actor relationship where she was acting in something I was doing, and then it kind of flipped, and then she was directing and I was shooting a movie, The Overthrow, like you mentioned. And then so it was through The Overthrow that I met Annabelle for the first time, and I kind of just thought that she had a really great screen presence and really wanted to put her in something. And so when it came time for Bluebird, we kind of asked her and were like, is this something you'd be interested in? And she was in between two really big TV projects. So this is obviously a much further out there idea. It's like going from Australian TV to a tiny medieval fantasy musical. She's also very self-conscious about singing, despite having a beautiful voice. But we kind of asked her. She sat on it. Phoebe did some convincing. And in the end, she said yes, and I was so happy with everything she did. She has a beautiful singing voice, which she didn't want to admit. And then she just delivered on all the scenes, including my death scene where she's cradling me and I had to play dead. And I felt emotional watching her react to me dying.
Well, I was gonna say, like, there's that level of you being in it too. Like, again, you're directing yourself in some capacity, but specifically having those action moments as well. Like, Home and Away doesn't give you that kind of stuff. You know, they don't have that kind of stuff. So there's got to be a joy in being able to lean into that medieval action style, which you do so well. The action is such a compelling thing. She must have enjoyed that and been thrilled by being able to get to use that kind of skill.
So Annabelle, I think in the end actually had a lot of fun doing the fight scene stuff. Every time she'd pick up a sword, even if she wasn't on camera, she would pose with it, do swings with it. The morning before the night shoot, she would go out there with the bow and arrow and actually practice with it. Even though a lot of the time the arrows are a visual effect, she would still make sure she looked right holding it, and that was great fun.
And again, that action is so compelling. So you put as much dedication into the musical side of it as you do to the action side, and none of it's kind of, you're not meeting it at like a, oh, I'm only really interested in the musical side. You are so compelled and interested in both of these styles that they just, it seamlessly flows together. And I guess that comes back to the whole cohesiveness of the film, right? Which you've already talked about in some capacity, but I just kind of want to ask again before we talk about Fantastic Fest, getting that cohesive nature and having gone through all of the stuff that we've talked about, like the pre-shooting and planning and then the shooting and then editing and then putting it together. When you first watched it and you've got your final product, you've got the final film there, what's your feelings of knowing that it does cohesively work together? Like, how did you feel after that?
I think I don't think there was ever one moment where I knew if it worked or it didn't, because a lot of the time when you're doing something that's very reliant on visual effects, music, sound effects, and color, a lot of time, even if I've got a locked edit where all the timing is good, all the shots are good, I'll watch it and be like, well, this doesn't feel anything like what I wanted. This is so far away from what I thought it would be. And then piece by piece, you do another VFX shot, you do another a piece of sound design. I tinkered so much with the music to try and get it exactly how I wanted it. And I think it's only at the very end that you're like, I think it's over the line now. I think I've crossed the threshold of I'm convinced by it, but I'm actually not sure anymore. So there's no as beautiful as it would be to be like, it's done, it's my, I'm happy. I don't think I've ever actually had that. And I think this one especially, because it was so post-production, having got sculpted so much in post, I think that it was just about knowing what little pieces were right to get to an end result.
And then obviously Fantastic Fest, which is great. Congratulations for being part of that.
Thank you.
What was your, what are you hoping the audiences get out of getting to see Bluebird there?
I'm actually really not sure. I've never seen this movie with a live audience before, so I'm really hoping people like it, but it'll be interesting because I think it is different to most Australian short films in its structure and its surprises, and I really hope that an audience reacts to that and doesn't get bored or
I can tell you, I've watched it twice. They're not going to get bored. Yeah, and especially with an audience like this, like I know Fantastic Fest is so, like it's a genre-friendly festival, but usually it's like science fiction or horror. And so I can imagine that the excitement of getting to see something like this, which is playing with a different style of genre than they're used to, is just going to delight them because you know, it's unexpected. As you're saying, it's unlike other Australian shorts. And I guess then it's a good question to ask if was that a deliberate thing to create something that is so unlike other Australian shorts or Australian films in general?
I think that because I'm a very visual effects heavy filmmaker and I've had visual effects in my life for so long, a lot of my ideas start with like, what's the furthest, hardest thing I can do right now with my abilities? And I don't think it's ever come from a place of giving the audience something different. I think I've always just wanted to push myself technically as far as I can. And I think a lot of the time that just lands in genre because genre filmmaking really does push all the technical boundaries. And I think that's just what I find most satisfying is going, okay, I've done a sci-fi, now medieval, and how far can I push this with budget limitations and time limitations and things like that?
Well, it's really quite something. So as we lead to wrapping up, the last question which I usually ask Australian filmmakers is about what it means to be an Australian filmmaker working today and being able to tell stories on screen. And like lately, and obviously don't have to get into politics and all this kind of stuff, but the politics of the art has been really kind of ramped up. Obviously we've got an election coming up and things like that. But the access for people to be able to be a filmmaker, to have that avenue into having a career and things like that is really, really hard. And sometimes it's, you know, again, not knowing whether you can actually do it or not. So I'm curious, with all of that in the back of your mind, what does it mean to be an Australian filmmaker working today and putting stories on screen?
I think I'm a very, very proud Australian filmmaker just because I think Australia does have a really beautiful network, especially Sydney. It's very, if you know a couple of people, then they'll know other people, and it's very easy to get to know the right people to make things happen. And I think Hollywood's getting especially decentralized now, where everything's moving away for tax purposes and other reasons. And I think that Australia will probably keep on getting better for movies, and I think hopefully no matter what the government is doing, we'll continue to monetarily support young filmmakers. And I love making movies in Australia. I think even if I make internationally set movies, I think I'll always probably shoot them in
Yeah,
Australia.
it's comforting to hear. I'm excited to see where you go as a filmmaker. I've enjoyed watching what you do. And so, you know, your vision and scope of what you're putting on screen is just exciting. I'm glad that you're around and putting your story on screen. It's delightful. So thank you, Darwin. I appreciate it.
No, thank you, Andrew. It's been great. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this chat with Darwin Schultz. Bluebird screens as part of the Sydney Shorts package at Fantastic Film Festival Australia on 27th of April 2025. For other interviews and reviews, visit thecurb.com.au. I'll see you on the next one.